All right. Welcome to the show. Super excited. We have an amazing guest today. We have Lou Webb, and he's going to share his life story, and he's got so much wisdom and just knowledge, and he's also an amazing hunter. So we're going to dive into some of those hunting stories. So welcome, Lou.
Well,
awesome. So the whole point of, you know, Bear Fruit Life is, you know, I had a mentor once tell me, like, go find somebody with fruit on the tree and learn from them and let their ceiling be your floor. And I think that, you know, there's a lot of people out there who can learn from just your story. And so we're just going to dive into that, and just, I'll ask questions. I'll stop you and say, hey, tell me more on that. And it'll be fun. So, Lou,
whoever that was that told you that, to, they were a smart person, because we all need people with age and wisdom and experience to help us navigate.
Yeah.
Because life is, as M. Scott Peck said in The Road Less Traveled, life is difficult.
Yeah, no, it is. And we all go through hard times, and we need people on our side and by our side and all of that. So, yeah. So going off of that, who's somebody in your life, or was somebody in your life that you look up to, or that was able to walk, you know, that was a mentor?
Interestingly, other than my father, mm-hmm. Who I lost about 5 years ago, he was 83. Hmm. In fact, I bear his name. I'm actually the third. My father was Junior, and my paternal grandfather, who I never knew, died when my dad was three, so he never knew him either.
Okay.
Was Lewis McKinney Webb.
Wow. So should I change your name to the third on that?
No. And I won't tell you the times my dad called me the turd. Anyway. my father, my maternal grandfather was a hugely significant man in my life. He was born in North Carolina, ended up in West Virginia, was a coal miner. My mom is the coal miner's daughter, only child. but my maternal grandparents were hugely significant in my life. And he taught me all kinds of things, because my father was working all the time. I remember when my dad had three jobs at one time. But my dad worked a lot. Not that he didn't spend time with me. He did.
Yeah, yeah.
But my grandfather stepped into the gap and taught me things like how to start a fire, how to fish, how to hit a baseball, how to throw a baseball. And he was just so present in my life, and just a fine Christian man. My grandma one time took me into my grandfather's bedroom, and they had separate bedrooms from as long as I can remember, because my grandpa snored like a freight train, and that's probably putting it mildly. She took me into his bedroom, and he was at that time in his 90s. He lived in 97. And she showed me on his bedspread these two kind of dark spots on his bedspread about a foot apart. And she said, do you know what those are? And I said, some sort of stain. Now, my grandma could get any stain out of anything. She was unbelievable.
Grandmas are good at that.
But she said, I can't get those stains out. And I said, what are those? And she said, that is where your papa, and I'm a papa now too.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because of him. That's the name, grandpa name I took. She said, that's where he comes in 2, 3, 4 times a day and gets on his knees in his 90s and prays.
Wow.
And that's his elbows where he prays, and those stains are on that bedspread because he did it so much.
Wow.
So he was a significant, the most significant male in my life at that time, again, because my dad was working so much.
Yeah.
And then one other guy, my sophomore football coach, Kerry Brody, who passed a few years ago, was a very significant man in my life.
Nice.
But those are the three.
Yeah.
Big ones.
Yeah. No, that's awesome. And it sounds like your grandpa sounds like he was a saint, basically.
It's interesting. It's interesting you would say that. And I know he wasn't.
Yeah.
However, when I get to heaven, I absolutely expect to find that my mama, my mom's mom, my papa's wife, is an angel. I fully expect that.
Yeah.
She lived to be 102, almost 102.
Wow.
They were married. Get this. They were married for 75 years. They celebrated their diamond wedding anniversary.
Wow.
75 years.
That's amazing.
And she was, I can't ever remember having her into my 50s. Okay.
Yeah.
So had a lot of experience with my mama. I can't think of a single time I ever saw or heard her do anything I would think was sinful. Never heard a bad word. Never even heard her say hell or damn.
Yeah.
Not even sure I heard her say heck. But those two people, very important.
Wow. That's awesome. So, I mean, it sounds like, and you're a part of a, you know, it seems like your family, you're a part of a legacy almost. Like it's, you're building a legacy in a way.
I think.
Well, you're a part of their legacy. And I mean, I think that can be looked at in different ways, but yeah.
Yes. And I think if I could ask my grandparents what the legacy they would like me to carry forward and my children and now seven grandchildren. If I could pass a legacy on to them, I think my grandparents would want the legacy to be purely and simply Christ.
Yeah. Amen.
I think that's the legacy.
Yeah. That's beautiful.
And I can tell you, I think my grandma is an angel. I can tell you I most assuredly am not. Just ask my wife.
me and Lou had lunch last week or so, and he's got four daughters and I'm about to have three, and so I was saying, what do I do?
Pray a lot. You know those stains on the bedspread?
Yeah.
I need some create stains. Those You betcha, brother.
I do. I'm excited. So, but tell me, Lou, tell me your story. I want to know, you know, your story.
Born in 1958 in Southern California, and the first generation of my family for several generations not to have been born in Western North Carolina, Kentucky, Tennessee, or West Virginia.
Okay.
So I'm a hillbilly genetically.
From the South.
You can tell by the way I say y'all and I'm fixing to do this. And it's, anyway, so I was first generation of my family born in Southern California. I have a sister 3 years older and a little brother who's 16 years younger, same mom and dad. His name's Jeremy. Was raised in Orange County and, went all the way from, kindergarten through 12th grade, graduated from a high school called Los Alamitos High School, in Orange County, and, grew up, sports.
Yeah.
It's a big part of my upbringing, as I know it was for you too. We played all the sports back then. And I liked football the most, but played basketball, played baseball, and ran track and because that's how it was done back then. Now people specialize
in certain. Back then it's like you did everything.
Yeah, you did it all, which I think, quite frankly, I think produced overall better rounded athletes because we did play all those sports. But that's just my opinion.
Yeah, wouldn't argue.
But so raised there, raised in a Christian home, both parents believers, all three grandparents that I knew. My dad's mom was Mama Webb, mom's mom, Mama Stafford, and Papa Stafford. So raised in a Christian home, though they were from West Virginia, almost all the family moved to Southern California. So I had all of these aunts and uncles. My dad was the baby of 9 children.
Oh, wow.
My mom was an only child. So that was an interesting dynamic. Imagine that. But yeah, so had lots of aunts and uncles and grandparents around and lots of family events and holidays and 4th of July parties and Thanksgivings that were just crazy. And so family, faith, sports.
Yeah.
That was kind of my life. I do have to give a shout out to the Beaver Boys. There are 8 of us. Actually, there are 7 of us left. One passed away. Who all met the first day of kindergarten.
Wow.
With the exception of one guy who got grandfathered in because we played Little League baseball and everything, but he actually went to a different grammar school and junior high, but we all went to the same high school, but we were friends from the time we were very young. We played on the same junior American football team. I think we were 10.
Yeah.
And, but we call ourselves the Beaver Boys because we went to this school, Jack L. Weaver, and we were the Weaver Beavers. And, but the, we have for many, many years, all stayed very connected, very, in just connected, even though one of the guys, lives in New York. One guy lives, part of the time in Oregon. I live in Colorado, San Diego and Orange County. And, but at least once a year, we all get together as a group and have a Weaver Beaver Boys Weekender.
That's awesome.
And so those also growing up, having those relationships, again, primarily based on the fact we were athletes, was really important. Yeah. So I felt like growing up in this little town called Los Alamitos that I grew up in Mayberry,
for
lack of a better term. I mean, it was a really special upbringing. We all had parents that worked very hard. I think there was, in the whole group, I think there was only one divorce in all of the parents. And in this group, we've been buddies for now 59 years. We're all 64.
Wow.
Actually, Ira just turned 65, Medicare. Anyway, and we gave him some heat on that. There's not in this group of 8 guys, not one divorce.
Wow. So what does that, I mean, let's stop on that for a little bit. I mean, what does it mean to have, you know, I've found a group of guys that, and we connect and we stay connected and we do trips. One of them's getting married here in February and we do a talk. We connect every Thursday morning at 6:30, which was this morning.
Awesome.
And, but a lot of males, a lot of guys don't have that type of connection, or fellowship. And so, I mean, what would you say to somebody who doesn't have that, or how would they create that? You know, how would they go and say, hey, how do you be intentional about that? Because I'm sure between out of the 8 of you guys that haven't had a divorce, I'm sure you guys have also walked through some hard things in life with each other.
Kyle, great question. And you're right. We have walked through some very difficult things together. As a part of this, it's important to know, three evangelicals, a Catholic, a Mormon, an agnostic, and two Jews.
Sounds like a joke.
Pretty walked into a bar.
Yeah.
So our connection wasn't faith. Our connection was age.
Yeah.
We all literally were 5 years old when we met that first day of kindergarten.
Yeah.
Except for Chewbacca, and he came just a bit later because he's almost 6'8". We call him Chewbacca. But it was sports that was our initial connection. And then as we grew up, we spent a lot of time in each other's homes. Mm-hmm. And just played together, grew up together, started chasing girls together, you know, had our first experiences of lots of things, drinking a little bit or this or
oh, yeah.
those life experiences. But most of us have some relationships like that. Not yeah. necessarily eight guys, but,
sure.
but you know, two or three guys that you yeah. shared a lot with. Exactly. Here's the most important part. You have to be, and you use the right word, you have to be intentional about watering and fertilizing that garden.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't water and fertilize the rose garden, there won't be any roses.
Yeah.
Okay. You need to take the time and be intentional about getting together and saying, yes, we could always do something else, but this is important enough to all of us that we take the time to be together.
Yep.
And so that is the number one thing, particularly as we get older, our lives get busier. And there was a period of time when we were all, you know, newlyweds and starting to raise our families and things like that, that we didn't do that during those times. We stayed connected.
Sure.
But we didn't take the time to do this get together. We've been doing that for, probably close to 30 years now.
Oh, wow.
But in those earlier times, we didn't.
Yeah. You're focused on the family. And
so, but you have to be intentional about doing it, about keeping those relationships alive. And that's important.
Yeah.
That would be how I would say to do that.
I might be out of the screen.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. So from there,
went to high school.
I'm gonna grab my water.
Okay. Went to high school and kind of specialized in football. And was good. Okay, that's okay. Pretty good football player. Had some scholarship offers coming out of high school, and ended up going to a small school in Washington, where I made some more great lifelong friends on the football team and roommates.
Nice. What position?
I was an offensive guard and outside linebacker, defensive end, depending on the set. Enjoyed that very much. Played for 2 years up there, and then I transferred to the University of Southern California.
Okay.
And joined a fraternity, and actually was going to walk on and try to play there, and ended up playing fullback on the USC rugby team.
Wow.
Which was...
Yeah, rugby's no joke.
Oh, yeah, it was a lot of fun. That was a great sport. And then made some more, a theme here, made some good, lasting, lifelong friends.
Yeah.
In various stages. And again, all of those friends, it takes time to keep those relationships viable.
Yeah.
And so I've been fortunate with that and have some some friends that are very, very important to me. Came back after college. I came back from Washington, went to USC. At the end of USC in 1980, I got a job in Houston, Texas, moved to Houston, Texas, became the urban cowboy. Because loved it, loved that kicker dancing. And, you know, I was old enough, so go to bars on the weekends and learn to dance and wear blue jeans and cowboy boots.
There you go.
It was pretty funny. Then came back from that and went, always had intended to go into the family business that my father had started. Eventually, he had a service station in this little town that we lived in, a Texaco service station. And then that turned into another little spot that he rented some cars and trucks out of and sold a few used cars. And then that turned into a bigger operation with sales and leasing. And then that eventually in 1974, he and two other guys partnered and bought a little Toyota dealership in Hawaiian Gardens, California. And in 1982, if I remember correctly, he then built a dealership, a new Toyota dealership out in Cerritos on the 605 freeway in the Cerritos Auto Mall. And from there, that just kept
going
into nine dealerships in Orange and Los Angeles counties. And I started when I was 11, when I started on during summers, Monday through Friday, I would sweep his little used car lot there.
Yeah.
Los Alamitos Boulevard every morning with a push broom, and I'd sweep the entire lot. And he paid me a whopping 50 cents a day. So I made $2.50 a week, but I had my own money.
Yeah.
I always liked having my own money.
Yeah.
And so then from there I learned.
Well, everything. Let's go back to that. Tell me, you know, a lot of people just have things kind of like handed to them. And that definitely wasn't the case. It sounds like your dad built something from nothing and he taught you how to work hard.
He did.
And
my mom
as
well was a big part of that. They were both, she took homemaking
mm-hmm.
very, very seriously. My mom was an amazing mom and she made homemaking a really serious job.
Yeah.
And did it really well.
And it's probably the most important job, to be honest.
Oh, so important.
Yeah.
So many kids that are raised latchkey kids now and don't go home to mom. And I can't remember, Kyle, honest to goodness, I can't remember until I was probably, I don't know, probably junior high school.
Yeah.
So that would have been seventh grade. I'm not sure I ever came home from school that my mom wasn't home to, you know, give me a little snack, debrief me a little bit on what happened for the day. Just that was a valuable thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, I was taught to work, you know, had chores at home, empty the trash cans, make your bed, that kind of stuff. You know, I washed cars and then I worked in the parts department, the service department, sales. I loved selling cars. I really enjoyed that.
Yeah.
Was my favorite job I ever had. In college, I worked as a waiter.
Yeah.
Going to USC at the 32nd Street Cafe and Saloon. I just have always thought that was kind of one of the things you were supposed to do.
Yeah. Just work hard and, I mean, amazing skills as far as like being a waitress or waiter and selling cars and all of it. I mean, amazing
loved
skills.
It. Yeah. Loved it all. And so eventually, got to go back. When I was 25, a buddy that I had played Little League baseball, gone to junior high and high school with, and played football with in high school. He was one of our quarterbacks. He calls me. I'm at work. I'm selling cars. I'm work at Toyota Cerritos. And he calls and he goes, "Hey, you want to meet me for happy hour?" And I said, "Yeah, I get off 6 o'clock or whatever, 5 o'clock, whatever it was." And I said, "Yeah, sure. Where?" And he goes, "Well, there's this new place in Huntington Beach called the Crazy Burro. And it's a Mexican restaurant, but I hear they have really good appetizers and
happy." Yeah, yeah.
Okay, yeah, that'll be great. I'll see you there. And he calls back about an hour or so later and he goes, hey, I just talked to this gal that I went to college with. I went to Long Beach City and Cal Poly, San Luis with. And he said, I asked her if she wanted to join us. He said, she probably won't. She's a teacher. It's a school night. She's not really a partier. But if she shows up, is that okay? I said, yeah, fine. So so I meet him there, and we're having a beer at the bar. And so I got to go to the bathroom. So I stand up, walk in. I walk out of the bar, and I'm walking across the lobby of the restaurant. And all of a sudden, the front door opens, and in walks this stunning blonde. And I just kind of – we almost bump into each other. And I kind of stand back. We kind of smile at each other. And I just kind of step out of the way. And she walks by. And I remember I stopped and turned around and watched her walk away. To this day, I remember what she was wearing. And I thought, wow, you know, she was hot. Go to the bathroom, come back in. She's sitting next to my buddy. And now we have been married for 37 years.
Wow. 37 years, four kids, seven grandkids.
Yeah. So anyway, that was a huge part. By the way, we were born in the same hospital.
Wow.
I played football at La Salle, and she was a cheerleader at our rival high school, Milligan.
Oh my gosh. Small world.
Small world. But yeah, so that, and I'm married to the best human being I know. I would have said second best because my mama Stafford would have been, but now I'm pretty sure she's an angel. So
yeah.
So Laura's human. So she's,
she qualifies. That's awesome. Well, give me, give me some tips on, you guys have been married for 34 years and you got a great lineage of families, you know, staying together, you know. Give the audience some tips on some
how to advice. Have a long marriage.
Yeah.
Okay. It's really simple. And I know this is going to probably come off to your audience as being way too simple, but it really isn't. The key to a long marriage, just don't get divorced. And I mean that sincerely, because I promise.
Yeah.
At some point in a marriage, you're going to want to.
Mm-hmm.
And you just kind of hope that you don't want to at the same time.
Mm.
Because men and women are, I think God has a great sense of humor. I really do. I think God has a great sense of humor. And he created men and women so different, and then said, here, live joyfully together, right?
Have kids.
Yeah. And but no, it's communication, tolerance, recognizing that the only thing that we can control in our lives is our words and our actions. We cannot control another person, whether it's our children, friends, parents, siblings, or spouse. We can't control them. So for us to say, well, you need to do this, or you need to do that, or you need to be this way, or you need to be that way, we all do that.
Yeah.
But if we looked in a mirror more often, we would find more answers to marriage than looking at the other person and thinking what they should do to make this work.
Yeah.
And it's hard. Marriage is hard.
Yeah.
But it's worth it.
Absolutely.
I think it's the hardest thing two human beings ever do, but it's worth it. And now with pushing up on 40 years, it gets easier in many ways. I think some of that me Tarzan, you Jane stuff, particularly for us A-type guys, fades. And it just, it gets the love becomes more mature. When we're younger, a lot of our love is based on lust. Because we're, you know, when you're young, especially as males,
yeah,
you know, that sex drive is huge.
Yep.
And, but as we age, not that that goes away, but it, the rest of the relationship, mm-hmm. the marriage becomes really important.
Yeah.
To, at least this is how it's worked for me. And trust me.
No, I agree.
I'm married to an incredibly, incredibly good person. And I am most assuredly not an incredibly good person. And
that's not true.
We have made it.
Yeah.
So that's a good thing.
Yeah. No, that's awesome. I think that's great advice. Just simply don't get divorced. It's that.
Just don't quit.
Simple. Don't quit.
Just don't quit.
Yeah.
It's exactly that simple. Figure it out.
Yeah.
Work through it. Just don't quit.
Yeah. I mean, that's just like in anything in life, you tell, you know, hey, you're not going to quit in your business. You're not going to quit in your sport. So why are you going to quit in your relationship?
Probably.
Yeah. Awesome. So from there, met your wife and then.
So then at that time, like I say, I was selling cars. And then after that, I became a new car sales manager at one of our dealerships. And then I became a general manager at another small Toyota dealership that we bought,
mm-hmm.
and Toyota, it was Toyota Buena Park. And, so that was my first chance to, as a dealership manager, then ran a little dealership, called, Lou Webb and Son Toyota.
Yeah.
Out of Mission Viejo. And then we turned that dealership into a Lexus dealership and ran that store. And then eventually became the executive vice president of the Webb Automotive Group. We had 9 dealerships, 1,100 employees. It was quite a load.
Yeah.
And then in 1998.
Tell me about the management of 1,100 employees. Like what was some of the keys, you know, to be able to manage that many people and still maintain culture and have success and all of that?
Great question. A couple of things I would say. One is recognizing that the success of any business that has employees is to a great huge degree the success of the employees. It's the success of your people, and recognizing that. In fact, if you do, I've seen several surveys of why people work where they work, and one would immediately say, well, how much I get paid.
Yeah,
actually that's typically third or fourth on the list depending on the survey. Excuse me, almost invariably, the number one answer is respect for management. And I think what they respect is typically number two answer on those surveys, the ones I've seen anyway, that says that they are made to feel like they are valuable to the success
of the company. Business. Yeah.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
That they're... The work they do is part of what makes that business successful. And so 1,100 employees, you're always going to have some eggheads. You're
sure.
going to have some people that are just bad eggs. When you find them, you
get rid of them.
Get rid of them. And, but you're, what you ask of your people, be loyal to our company. Well, that road goes two ways.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, be loyal to them.
You have to be loyal to your people as well. They have to know that you trust them.
Mm-hmm.
They have to know that you value them. So that is to me the key to whether you've got 3 employees or 3,000 or 300,000. They have to know that they're valuable.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree. I think that's key. Like letting that person know that they're valued, and it's not always about the pay, but it's about how they feel valued in the company and how they contribute and all of that. And you said they respect their managers. And so you were finding the right managers to be in place to be able to, you know, cultivate that culture of mutual respect and value and all that. So that's good advice.
It's interesting. I called what I did MBWA. Management by walking around. Sounds pretty simple. I made it a point to get around and see my people, to know them, to know their names, know their wives' names, know where they live, know their kids' names, know personal things about them, so that when I saw them, and I'm not just talking about management or the sale, I mean everyone, the guy that washes the cars and the guy that is the janitor and the guy that sells the cars and the general manager, from top to bottom, or I should say from side to side, it's important to walk around, be visible to your team, and to know who your team are. So you can say, hey, Hernan, did your daughter get that promotion? Or, hey, I remember you told me your dog was sick.
Those kinds of things. Yeah.
But they have to be, Kyle, they have to be genuine.
Yeah.
You have to genuinely care.
Yeah.
Because if you don't, that will come through too.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely about the relationship over the, you know, it's relational versus transactional or whatever. You know, it's like, it's all about the relationship, and that's key to everything.
And try to lead by example.
Yeah.
Try to work hard. If you're walking across a lot and there's a piece of paper blown around, bend over and pick it up.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if just don't ask of your team things that you wouldn't do.
Mm-hmm.
That's also, to me, a big part of it.
Yeah. Nice. Awesome. So,
I had that, by the way, I had that modeled for me by my father.
Mm.
My father was the hardest working man I ever knew.
Hmm. That's awesome.
He was a great example. And I, man, what a great example.
Hmm. Then what?
Then in all of a sudden in 1998, an outfit called Republic Industries, which was headed by Wayne Huizenga, out of Fort Lauderdale, Florida, did a big deal with Bedard for that video company. I'm trying to think of the name of the video company. Anyway, Waste Management.
Mm-hmm.
He had this concept called AutoNation. And this was in the late 90s. And they were buying a bunch of dealership groups around the country and building these big, giant used car stores. And buying the dealerships around them and then funneling used cars to these big, I call them mausoleums. And then getting their idea was to get the economy of scale in advertising and business office function and so on, centralizing it. And they came along and said, want to sell them? And so after about a year of negotiations and back and forth and a lot of late nights at Morrison and Forrester, which was the attorney office in Newport Beach, came to terms and sold all 9 dealerships.
Nice.
And all of a sudden I was 40 years old and retired.
Wow.
Weird, weird, totally unexpected, crazy life occurrence.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what was it like being 40 and all of a sudden you're retired, and what was that like? I mean, you have probably friends that are far from that, and then you have other friends that are, you know, that, but they're 20 years older than you. So like, what?
It was weird.
Mm-hmm.
And took a while to kind of find my equilibrium. I worked as a consultant for AutoNation for about a year, mm-hmm. after that. And then I had a little thing just out of my house, a little leasing company. I just had a lot of contacts of people call me and want cars, and I would arrange it.
Yeah.
But it was interesting at that time, I was on the board of Forest Home Christian Camping and Conferencing Ministry in Southern California. They had a big camp in the mountains there. And my wife and our four daughters and I would go to summer. We do a summer camp, family camp there every summer for a week. And so I had been asked to be on that board, and I was. At the same time, I was also on the board of directors of Church Resource Ministry, CRM, which was a kind of a mid-sized missionary group with, I think, like that time, maybe 400 missionary units globally.
Mm-hmm.
So that gave me insight into the missionary world, which is, missionaries are amazing.
Yeah.
They are amazing people.
I agree.
When this happened, you know, my wife and I kind of started praying, you know, Lord, what do you want?
Yeah.
Because it says specifically in the Bible, to whom much is given, much is expected.
Yeah. Right?
And I didn't think that this happened so that I could just go lay on the beach and drink Mai Tais and play all 5 days a week. And, you know, so, but you know, we certainly did some of that and could do it.
Oh yeah,
enjoyed that. But I was I was on my way home from a church dessert. Laura and I, we would normally have been together, but there was a soccer playoff game for the girls.
Mm-hmm.
I think our twins were in the soccer playoffs that night, and they were like, what, 13 or something.
Yeah,
something
yeah.
like that at the time. And so I'd been to all the soccer games. And so Laura said she was going to go to the playoff game and I was going to go to this dessert. So I went to the dessert, and I was on the way back from that, coming up Golden Lantern, we'll never forget. And all of a sudden I got the answer. And it was the most profound spiritual experience I ever had.
Hmm.
I was driving along, and I was thinking, I used to not remember what I was thinking, but I do remember what I was thinking. I surfed almost every morning. I would get up, go to the gym at like, you know, 5, work out till it got light, go to the beach, surf for an hour, and then go home, take a shower, and go to work. So that was just a routine. My wife never woke up with me in bed. Not very often. And so anyway, I remember I was thinking about where I was going to surf the next morning. Cause if I remember, there was a swell or there was a storm somewhere. And I was trying to think of what beach was going to catch the swell the best to go surf the next morning. And all of a sudden I got the answer. Now, I didn't hear a voice or see a vision or anything. I just got an epiphany that left me shaking. Excuse me. I had to pull over.
Hmm.
And I used to race cars when I was younger. And so driving is not something that I fear I'm going to lose control of a car going straight
yeah.
on a 4-lane road. But I was so shaken, I had to pull over. And what I got was that God wanted us to go somewhere Durango, believe it or not, pretty specific, and build a place to do retreats for missionaries, pastors that were struggling. Being a pastor is a very hard job.
Yeah.
Where do you go to? You're pouring yourself into your flock all the time. Where do you go to get your tanks refilled?
Yeah, to get recharged. Yeah.
Right. And so that's a big issue. And just some place to do ministry. Now, I'm not a warm and fuzzy preacher type, you can tell. I'm sure your viewers can tell too. But we, that's what I got. And a lot of detail in this epiphany. I mean, a lot of detail of what he wanted. And so I went home. Now, we live in Southern California. We're both born and raised in Southern California. And this yeah. is here. Move at 40, some 41 or 42 or whatever it is, to Southern California, and or from Southern California to Southwestern Colorado, where there's no beach and it's cold and there's this white frozen stuff that falls out of the sky yeah. and go live there. And, you know, okay. So I remember I got home and Laura was asleep. And I remember I even sat down on the bed kind of hard to see if she would wake up because I wanted to tell her.
Yeah.
Anyway, not that she snored, but she was sound asleep. And so the next morning she wakes up and I'm like this looking at her.
Waiting. Yeah.
Now remember, she never woke up with me in bed hardly yeah. ever anyway. And she goes, "What?" And I said, I got something to tell you. "What?" And I told her what had happened. And I said, "So, you know, here's this woman with four little girls and, you know, and her eyes are getting bigger and bigger and bigger as I'm telling her this story." And I get done and I said, "So what do you think that means?" And she goes, "Well, I think I better tell you something." And I said, "What?" She goes, "The last waking thought I had before I went to sleep was to remember to tell you that I think what God wants us to do is go someplace in the mountains and build a lodge and do ministry retreats for pastors and missionaries."
Wow.
So, wow. So then I said, "What do you think that means?" And her answer, with fear in her eyes, she said, I think that means we're moving to Durango, Colorado."
Hmm.
6 months later, we lived here.
Wow. Wow. So you just sold the dealership, retired at 40, and you're on the way home. You were shaking because God had told you, "Hey, I want you to go move to Colorado, Durango, open up a lodge and have pastors and missionaries go and have a retreat, recharge, you know." And God told your wife the same thing.
I've always wondered, Kyle, no way to ever know this, if at the exact moment I was
getting
that epiphany,
if she was. Yeah, I'm sure.
Hers, I got a lot of detail. Hers was just more, "I got to tell you, I think we need to go to the mountains and build a place to do ministry events." But I just, something has always told me that that happened simultaneously.
Hmm.
But I have no way of knowing.
Yeah.
But it pretty much made me feel like it was real.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. I think there's so many times in life where like God tells us to do something and it's super scary. And that's how you kind of know it's the right thing a lot of times.
Yes.
Besides God, like confirming it to, you know, your wife and you, you know, basically at the same time, was there doubt where you're like, "Hey, I'm going to do this and I'm not sure how it's going to happen, but I'm still going to do it"? Do you remember, like, was there fear or was it like, "Hey, it was clear. We just need to do this and it's going to work out"?
You know, I don't recall there being any fear about it. I don't recall there being any real question as to whether it was real or not.
Yeah.
And I think part of the reason for that is so many things instantly began to happen that confirmed it.
Hmm.
Okay. Just obstacles to possibly doing this just began to fall down in front of us. And I could sit here for an hour and tell you
yeah.
things happen, but I know we don't have that kind of time, but it was confirmed in many, many ways from the moment I told Laura and she told me what she had experienced. From that point forward, it just became quite obvious that this was real.
Hmm. That's awesome. I love the obedience and when God speaks and confirms, and that's awesome. So tell me, you know, over the next, you know, what, 20 or so years that God's, you know, had you built this amazing home and had retreats there, and was it amazing?
Yes and no. Interestingly, it's been hard to do, not because it wasn't that doing the retreats wasn't incredibly edifying and just uplifting, and the people that we have met through the years, the missionaries and the pastors and the feeling that we're doing what we're supposed to be doing was awesome. We live in a fairly liberal place.
Yep.
You and I.
Agreed.
It was made very, very difficult to do by county government and state government. Just wanted to just at every turn make it hard to do. And so what we had thought we were going to do is just do this and, you know, charge a nominal fee for the retreats. I mean, you go to a retreat, typically there's a little fee for the meals and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But they made it so hard to do that we just started doing it for free, just providing it. But the government, not a big fan, folks, of government.
We can get on that if you want.
You know, just do what you're supposed to do, government, and stay out of the rest of our lives. Way too much government. But it was they made it difficult. But again, when I was in the fraternity, I remember a Latin phrase, popo pete petulocula. And I was told, now that I think about it, I've never confirmed that. I was told, and I had to say it three times fast before the match burned or whatever. Anyway, that popo pete petulocula means those things worth having are most difficult to obtain. So just because things are hard to do, again, doesn't mean quit.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean stop. Doesn't mean throw the towel in. Just means figure it out.
Yeah.
Keep putting one foot in front of the other.
Yeah.
You know, if you feel like you're doing the right thing, keep doing it.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. I feel like that's almost like the theme that we keep seeing in your life is.
No, Kyle, let's be honest. My old man had to start from zero, maybe less than zero. Baby of 9 children, mom never remarried, dad died when he was 3.
Wow.
Interestingly, 9th child, 4th son, and yet he was named Junior.
I'm not sure how that works.
Typically, the first son is named Junior, right? So that was weird. hard scrabble, you know, born in 1934, went through World War II and Korea and all the stuff, West Virginia.
Yeah.
You know, not like typically the hotbed of great, you know, success and everything. So worked his ass off. And so I didn't have to start from ground zero.
Yeah.
I got to start a couple of rungs up the ladder. Not that when I say that, I started from ground zero in the jobs that I did, in the work that I did, but I didn't have to start it.
Yeah.
He started it.
Yeah.
And so I got a great benefit in that. And, you know, anybody that says that everything they've done on their own.
Well, that's not true.
It's not true. You gotta work hard. You gotta try to work smart, and you gotta catch a break.
Yeah.
If you don't catch a break, it's kind of like hunting, like my bow hunting, which is my great passion. I don't care how good of a hunter I am, and I think I'm pretty good at it.
Yeah.
If you don't catch some luck here and there, the freezer stays empty.
Yeah.
You gotta be good at it and diligent. But you got to realize, you know, life has lucky and unlucky parts too. Mm-hmm. That's part of it.
Yeah. No, that's good. And I think that's exactly kind of what the show's about, you know, Bear Fruit Life. Find somebody with fruit on the tree and learn from them and let their ceiling be your floor. And your father, his ceiling was your floor. And that's awesome.
I am a very, very fortunate guy.
Yeah.
Very fortunate guy.
Yeah.
God has blessed me a lot.
So I think we're running with time, but I do want to hear some of your hunting stories. So okay. Let me see. Yeah, we got 5 minutes. I want to hear some of your hunting stories. So tell me maybe the best hunting story, the biggest success hunting story, and the biggest loss, or just like worst experience ever.
Interesting. You know, Kyle, I'm a bow hunter. Mm-hmm. I have not hunted with a
rifle. So what does that mean for people who don't
know? I hunt with a bow and arrow, and I haven't hunted with a rifle for big game for 40 years.
And big game, let's...
Oh, you know, deer, elk, antelope, bears, sheep, moose, goats, big game, caribou.
Lions.
tigers and bears, no tigers. I like the challenge very much of hunting with a bow and arrow. You have to get very close. In fact, in the last 30 years, I have hunted exclusively with what's called a traditional bow. Most of you know a bow and arrow. Modern bow and arrows have kind of pulleys or cams and cables, and those are called compound bows. So when you draw the bow, it's hard, and then it gets easier as the cams break over. So you're holding a lot less weight here than the draw weight is. The bows I shoot, it's like I shoot a longbow. Think Robin Hood. Think American Indians. Think, you know, it's just a bent stick and a string and an arrow. And so I love the challenge of getting close. I like to be better at my craft, my woodcraft, my hunting craft. That's the fun to me, is the challenge. And to be successful, you have to be very, very close. So anyway, that's how I hunt. You know, to say my best hunt, my answer is yes.
All of them.
I'm fortunate where we live. I can walk out of my garage in the morning with my bow and walk up on the mountain and hunt elk and mule deer and bears, black bears and turkeys. And, I have most of my hunting is what we call DIY or do it yourself. But I have hunted. I've hunted in Africa. I've hunted in Europe. I've hunted in Canada and Mexico. So I've hunted around the world. And when you hunt in other countries, typically you have to have a, guide.
Yeah.
But if I, if it's in North America, or I should say the United States, I typically just hunt on my own, do it myself. I've had two great disappointments. We have short time here. One of them was I drew a tag in Wyoming in 2017, I believe. And actually I drew the tag in 2016 and had to defer it to use in 17 because I had just had a back fusion surgery and couldn't do the hunt. So they allowed me to defer it. The tag that I drew was called the Wyoming Bighorn Sheep Super Tag. They issue one a year. I think the odds that year, if I'm not mistaken, the odds were 13,149 to 1. And I drew that tag. Oh my gosh. It just so happens Rocky Mountain Bighorn Sheep are my nemesis. I can't seem to put one on the ground. I've had four Rocky Mountain Bighorn Sheep tags dating back to 1992 in Idaho. First time I ever applied for a tag. I spent 27 days solo backpacked in the mountains hunting bighorn sheep and did not get one. drew a tag here, I think in 06 in Colorado. That year, the sheep kind of disappeared from the unit that I hunted in. In fact, they sent a letter like a week or 10 days after the archery season had started to all the rifle tag holders that their season was after the bow season, saying you might want to think about getting your points or your money back, your preference points, because the bow hunters aren't seeing very many sheep. There were 20 people with archery tags. One person killed a ram out of the 20.
Wow.
The sheep just disappeared. But anyway, so I draw this tag. I go into Wyoming. I actually hired an outfitter, packed 17 miles on horses back into the Waukesha Wilderness in Wyoming. Almost got a ram the first afternoon, very close encounter. On the fifth day, I blew my right knee up and had to get helicoptered out of the mountains and ended up with a right knee replacement as a result. And so I'm pretty sure I'm the only guy in history that's ever eaten tag soup on a super tag.
Oh, gosh.
That was pretty disappointing. Anyway, there you go.
Man. That's not a fun one. You don't have – what about the most exhilarating hunt? Like one where you're just like your heart was –
I've hunted Cape Buffalo in Botswana and in Zambia. And a Cape Buffalo, the ones with the horns, they get big horn boss and the horns go like this. Not the horns that go like this, which is Crocodile Dundee. And that's a water buffalo, Asiatic water buffalo. I've hunted those as well. But Cape Buffalo, they're called Mbogo.
Mbogo?
M-B-O-G-O, Mbogo.
Mbogo.
But they're also called Black Death. And as far as I'm concerned, it's as scary as any hunting you can do. I've hunted grizzly bears, brown bears. All of the hunting, by the way, that I've done is legal. It's well-managed. It is... hunting is conservation, and a lot of people don't understand that. How do you kill something to make it better? Herds are much more viable, much more healthy because of managed, scientifically managed hunting. It keeps the proper numbers of animals in specific areas for the amount of food, water, and cover, and calving areas for, you know, ungulates. And that's the way it is. And so hunting is really, really important, the North American conservation model for hunting.
Yeah.
So all the stuff that I've hunted African lion once. I've hunted African elephant once. That might have been the scariest thing I've ever done with a longbow. Did not shoot one. but saw like almost 500 elephants in 13 days of hunting. But did not see any, only saw one legal bull, which is 15 kilo tusk on at least one side,
yeah.
one barely legal bull out of almost 500 elephants. It tells you poaching, which is illegal. It's a crime. It's not hunting. What do? They kill the big ivory. They rip the tusks out and leave the elephant to rot.
No, that's horrible.
And they sell it. But anyway, hunting Cape buffalo with a bow and arrow, I will tell you that had 100% of my attention. And I've taken three of them, and all of them were, my heart was pounding out of my chest. It was scary as could be.
What
kind of an adrenaline junkie, those.
What makes it so scary? Like,
because they'll kill you.
Oh. Yeah.
The thing about a Cape buffalo, yeah, they will just. In fact, I have a friend, Michael Fell, a PH in Tanzania. He just about a month or a month and a half ago got hammered by a buffalo. Fortunately, wasn't killed, and he had a rifle. Bob wow. Fontana, British Columbian outfitter that I knew back, I want to say in 06, was rifle hunting and got killed. They have a weird adrenaline system, Cape buffalo do. Unless your first shot is a really good shot, their adrenaline system kicks in and you can't stop them unless you shoot them in the brain.
Yeah.
And you don't shoot anything in the brain with a bow and arrow. So you don't stop a charging jackrabbit with a bow and arrow.
Yeah.
But yeah, they're scary because you know if you screw it up, you're very, very close to begin with, and it can get out of hand in a hurry.
Wow.
So anyway, I've had a lot of fun bow hunting. My family, all four of our daughters bow hunt, our three sons-in-law bow hunt. Our freezers are always full of
good meat.
Oh, good, high protein, low fat, no hormones, no steroids, no growth agents, you know, yeah. meat and weed and awful lot of wild game. So it's an important part of our family is hunting.
Nice. That's awesome. And great stories.
Ah. Yeah, I tell you, living them has been pretty fun stuff. And, you know, here's another thing to remember, especially given that I'm a bow hunter. Hunting with a bow and arrow, you don't fill as many tags as rifle hunters fill. The percentage of success is much lower.
Yeah.
And so what people have to understand also is that bow hunting is about the experience as much as it is about the meat or the trophy. When people say trophy, well, why do you think have things hanging on your wall? Well, why would I take the meat and leave those beautiful horns and beautiful hides to rot in the woods? That doesn't make sense.
No.
You know, if you're won the 50-yard dash and in sixth grade, and you got that blue ribbon hanging in a frame in your office, that's a
trophy.
A trophy. That's your important, that's something important to you.
Yeah. So
every one of the trophies that I have on the wall remind me of that moment, of that experience, of what the weather was like, how hard it was to climb that mountain with the packing that moose out by myself. You know, nine trips was like, or, you know, those things are important to have as my memories.
Yeah.
And so the fact that we eat the meat, and if you're in another country, the meat, I always make sure the meat goes to the locals. So it's never wasted. So people that kind of don't understand hunting, if they really understood it, would understand that it's important.
It's an important thing.
It's an important thing.
And it's a great sport. And it's, like you said, it's needed.
And climbing those mountains, they're getting steeper and higher every year.
Harder and harder.
Oh my gosh. Every year.
That's awesome. Well, Lou, I appreciate your time. I appreciate your story and just your wisdom and everything from, you know, that core group of guys, the Beavers. That,
Beaver boys.
Yeah, that you have, and that you said you're intentional with them to, you know, working hard and standing on your dad's shoulders and business and being obedient to God, to moving out from, you know, California on the beach to the mountains and the cold. And, you know, all of that, I think, is just, it's beautiful, man. So appreciate your time.
And I don't know if I had any wisdom for anybody, but I enjoyed the heck out of this. This right here is a good guy.
Thank you. Thanks. Plenty of wisdom. People are going to enjoy it. So thanks.
Okay, brother.
All righty. We'll catch you on the next one.